We are in chapter 16 of Revelation, and we have been looking at, in this section, the seven bowls of God's wrath being poured out. And last week we left off in talking about the Battle of Armageddon. And we were discussing the whole issue of this battle as it pertains to today, policies of today, of governments and so forth. It's interesting that this verse, Revelation 16 and verse 16, is the only place in the Bible where this is found. Okay? But yet consider all of the various teachings and philosophies and doctrines and policies and all of those sorts of things that have been written and put together about the Battle of Armageddon. Okay, now, if you go back to the Old Testament, there are many references and battles that have been fought and are recorded in the Old Testament in this area of Megiddo, as we talked about last time, the Valley of Armageddon. In Megiddo, there are several battles with the Israelites against others in this area. But what's happened is, people have taken, again, the prophecies and looked at them, made them what they want them to be, and turned the Battle of Armageddon into this worldwide physical battle that is going to be the war that ends all war and settles everything between the good and the bad and so forth. And what I want to do is share with you some things. This is out of a book. How many of you are familiar with Herbert W. Armstrong? Okay. Herbert W. Armstrong was the, I assume he's passed away. This latest revision was in 1980. He was 90 years old then. Okay. You what?
It's safe to assume.
Yeah. Herbert W. Armstrong, this is what it says on the back cover of this, recognized and respected by leaders in government, industry, and education around the world, is pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God. Then it goes on here and talks about different books and stuff that he's written and so on. Probably at that time was one of the most influential, well-known people in terms of biblical prophecy and what's going on today. This particular book, originally written in 1942, this particular revision was 1980. Let me share with you some things that he has in here to give you an idea of where this kind of stuff comes from. Okay, this whole Battle of Armageddon, and it's the U.S. and the allies against the Muslims, and all of that's going to take place in the Middle East, and we see all the stuff that's going on today, and, you know, it's getting ready to happen. Well, again, 1942 is when he originally wrote this. Okay, now there's a lot of stuff going on in the Middle East back then, and that was kind of the beginning of a lot of this, but we need to go back further. Okay, and understand some things. This is chapter 1 in this. He says, the lost master key has been found. All right? And he talks about in here about the ignorance of world leaders and educators and even Christians because they don't understand the truth about what the Bible teaches and so forth concerning all these matters. And here's what he has to say. Now see why heads of state, news analysts, and the great minds of our time do not comprehend the real meaning of world events as they are shaping up right now. A rational and right knowledge of this great purpose, of the Creator's master plan, of where in the progression of those foreordained events we stand today, and of major happenings prophesied yet to occur, this knowledge is the essential basis for understanding the significance and true meaning of today's dynamic world events, or world news. Without this vital knowledge, none dealing in news gathering and news reporting, none responsible for government policies can understand current world happenings or where they are leading. All right? So, because people are ignorant, and they're making these decisions based on this ignorance, okay, then the wrong decisions are going to be made. Well, I agree with that, okay? But I don't agree with where he goes with all of this. The all-important master key, he says, has been found. That key is knowledge of the astonishing identity of the American and British peoples, as well as the German, in biblical prophecies. This very eye-opening, astounding identity is the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. It is, at the same time, the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God. Seriously? The knowledge of the place of the American and British people, as well as the Germans, is the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible? Chapter number 2, prophecies closed until now. He says, we face today conditions such as the world never before has witnessed. Today the big problem is the stark question of survival. For the first time in world history, the weapons of mass destruction exist which can erase all life from the earth. Chiefs of government and world-famous scientists have been saying publicly, we must adjust to living in fear of human annihilation with no solutions in sight. Human annihilation, is that going to happen?
1980, it looked like a real possibility.
Yeah, it did in 1980. Okay. But should we be living in fear of human annihilation? Why not? What we've been looking at so far is the fact that, yeah, there's going to be a human annihilation of all those who don't belong to the Lord. Okay? So it's coming, and but not by the sources that these folks are thinking that it will. Another objector, he's talking about people who object cynically toward the Bible and so forth, another objector might ask, are not most of the prophecies outdated Old Testament writings addressed only to the ancient nation Israel, of no concern to us in our time? And the answer is an emphatic no. These scintillating dynamic prophecies were, most of them, never given to ancient Israel. The plain truth is, these prophecies were written for our people of our time and for no previous people or time. They pertain to world conditions of today and could not have been understood until today. And don't forget, the specific key that unlocks these closed doors of prophecy is the definite knowledge of the true identity of the American and British nations as they are mentioned in these prophecies. Then know this further. The greatest mystery book of the entire Bible to most has been the book of Revelation. But the book of Daniel is the key to the book of Revelation. And in the book of Revelation, solely and alone, do we find the world events of all prophecies correlated in order of time sequence. The book of Revelation then holds the key for putting together all the prophecies in proper time order. And Revelation 2 was a closed and sealed book until our time now. And where does this lead us? To the fact that prophecy generally was written and preserved for our time today. And some 90% of all prophecy pertains actually to this latter half of the 20th century. And the one central master key to prophecy as a whole is the identity of the United States and the British nations in these prophecies for today. These prophecies could not pertain to any time previous to our precarious present. That's the kind of stuff that you're hearing about, and you're listening to some of these folks talking about Revelation and the prophecies and the end of the world and the end times and all of that. That's the kind of stuff thinking that it's coming from. Okay? We go back to what we said originally in our study. If that's true, if the prophecies of Revelation were written only for our time, what meaning could it possibly have had to the first century Christians when they were reading any of those things? See? And so I point this out for you to be able just to know, you've got to be careful with the stuff that you're hearing out here about prophecies and Revelation and the end times and all of those kinds of things. This is a guy who was very influential. Okay, and, you know, again, policymakers and the government and everything else were listening to him
about these things. In fact, they often call the Worldwide Church of God the Armstrong Church.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that was a little more limited, that kind of led into, like, the Left Behind series,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot more mainstream
yeah.
than these were.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, we've got to be careful about, you know, looking at these things and seeing what are they really all about, okay? And when we go and we try, again, as I've said this before, we try to start plugging in specific people and events and times and say this is what it is for sure, then we're going to run into all kinds of problems. We've been seeing that as we've gone along. Different people that have said, oh, this is it, this is it. No, we're still here.
You know, okay. Russell, a lot of the stuff like what he wrote about, you hear even on TV today.
Oh,
like
that's what I'm saying. That's where a lot of this is coming from.
Politics into the events mm-hmm. and the events that are happening to Revelation. 700 Club, for example.
Oh, yeah.
They're doing a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pat Robertson's another one that supports a lot of this kind of stuff.
And it's unbelievable the things that they make people believe.
Yeah. Yep. So you have to be careful and you have to be discerning. And again, you know, above all in looking at these prophecies, not just these in Revelation, but all of them through the Scriptures, you've got to keep in mind the symbolism. Okay? It is symbolism more than anything else. It is given to bring forth a message to whoever's reading it at whatever time in history, whatever circumstance and situation they're in, and that overall message is what?
Things are bad.
They're going to get worse.
But victory is assured in the end. Okay? That message fits everybody for all time throughout history. And you look at different periods of history, as we've talked about, look at during the Middle Ages. All the things that were going on in history back then, a very isolated world in the sense that people, for the most part, most people couldn't read. They were very uneducated. Their world existed in their village or their town or their, you know, little farmlet or what have you. And when invaders came from other places, and was their world coming to an end?
Yeah.
Sure it was. Just as real and just as scary and so forth as things are for us today.
In fact, our problems are pretty trivial.
Yeah, compared to what a lot of those folks did, that's exactly right. See?
Because like you were saying, your village was your government. You know,
exactly.
We got a larger government protecting us here with the army and everything else versus
yeah.
what they did.
That was their whole world.
Yep.
You see? And then you throw in, you know, the Black Plague, and look at, you know, the all the fear and the people that died and, you know, and all that was surrounded with that, and you think that people were thinking the world was coming to an end then? Sure it was. You know, not to mention, you know, look at World War I and the atrocities of that, World War II. You know, as we've talked about, you start plugging people in there and, you know, that's what it means and that's what the application is, and so this is it. Just be aware that that's the kind of stuff that is being told out there, and so take it all with a grain of salt. All right? Again, the Battle of Armageddon, being taught by folks today, has to do with this idea of a physical battle between the side of righteousness, on the side of the U.S. and its allies and all the good people and Christians versus the Muslims in the Middle East. And that is a very, very dominant philosophy in the world today. It's driving a lot of policy and a lot of things that are going on. So keep that in mind. This reference in here, like, you know, so much of the stuff we've been seeing, it is a symbolic battle, is what it refers to. A symbolic battle or a battle of spiritual nature. Armageddon is symbolic of the battle that will take place, is how I meant to say that. It's not a symbolic battle. It's going to be a battle, but not a physical, but a spiritual battle. Between the forces of God and his enemies. And that's what we have to keep in mind. So when somebody's telling you, oh, the Battle of Armageddon is getting ready to take place over in, you know, in the Middle East, go out and buy yourself a nice dinner and, you know, tell them, you know, hey, forget it. I'm going to go in and keep on enjoying my life until the Lord comes back again. He knows when it's going to happen. All right, Judy?
Isn't there already a battle taking place between good and evil? So.
Yeah. And it has been since the Garden of Eden.
Exactly.
You know, so the Battle of Armageddon, you know, Armageddon as it's in here is basically a reference to that's when it's all going to end. Okay? That's when it's all going to come to an end and the victory will be assured. Look at what he says here beginning in verse 16. Then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. All right? Then the seventh angel, poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." Okay, it is done. What's done? Okay, what is finished or completed? Verse 18. Then there came flashes. Give me some new glasses. Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. How severe was it? No earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on earth. So tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Okay. Every island fled away, and the mountains could not be found. From the sky, huge hailstones of about 100 pounds each fell upon men. Think that'd do some roof damage? Okay. You wouldn't have to worry about calling your insurance to replace your roof, though, okay? And they fell upon men. And they, that is the men, cursed God on account of the plague of hail, because the plague was so terrible. What do we see happening here in this seventh bowl of wrath? What's going on here?
Destroyed.
Okay. He says it is done, right? We go back and we look at all these different plagues, these seven bowls of wrath that have come about, and as we said as we began this part of our study, this is God bringing out his vengeance upon those who are bearing the mark of the beast, the world. Okay? That warning that he gives in verse 15, go back to that. Behold, I come like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. We talked about that last week, the warning that Jesus gave and so many of his parables that he told. The idea is, be ready. Why? Because you don't know the day or the hour. Right? And you do not want to be caught, and we talked about this some last time, as he uses this, may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. And we're going to see that idea come up here in the next chapter again. Why is that issue so central to this whole study and issue here, and really throughout the Bible, this idea of being found naked? Okay.
Completely without protection.
Okay, that. Remember, last week we talked about this. We said, where does this originate from? It goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Okay? When God created Adam and Eve, remember, it said they were both naked and what? And they felt no shame. That was before sin came into the world. When Adam and Eve sinned, they disobeyed God. What was the immediate first thing that happened? What does it say? Immediately their eyes were open and they realized they were naked. Okay? So what is the real meaning of that and the impact of that?
Well, when God came in the cool of the day he said he was looking for Adam and Eve. And they said they hid themselves in shame.
Okay.
And they said, oh, Lord, we realized we were naked. He said, who told you were naked?
What did he say right after that? Did you partake of the fruit that I told you not to, right?
Yeah.
So what is the idea of the nakedness has to do with it? Nakedness exposes our shame and sinfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? The shame of our sin.
It's the knowledge. Their eyes become open.
Exactly.
The knowledge of their shame and guilt and realization.
Exactly. Okay? Then we talked about, Wes, I'll get you in just a second here. And we talked about, you know, Adam and Eve made clothes for themselves out of fig leaves, right? You know, they tried to cover themselves. Very inadequate. Which, you know, we can go back and do a full study on this, but just the idea of how inadequate man's attempts to cover and you know, save himself really are. Okay? What did it require?
Actually, sacrifice.
A sacrifice where God made clothes of animals for them, right? Okay? You know, so many people miss that. It's a very significant statement in that text, okay?
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about this before. Where did the animal skins come from? From animals. Animals had to die. Their blood being shed to cover man's nakedness, which represents their sinfulness. Okay? That blood being shed. That's why the Israelites, with the relationship with God, were given this, you know, all these sacrifices that they had to be making on a regular basis to remind them of what? Of their sin. Okay? All right? And so now we see Jesus saying to them, you know, hey, I'm going to come like a thief. Make sure you're ready. Why? Because you don't want to be found naked. Okay? Now hold on to that thought, because again, we get into chapter 18. I'm not sure if we'll get that far today or not, but if we do, we'll see some more of this. Wes, you had your hand up a moment ago.
Yeah, I was just wondering to type him out to the witness of his hand about what did we
just because we procrastinate, and there is no procrastination when we have something we have to deal with that affects our salvation, whether it's forgiving somebody or, I mean, how can we be caught naked if we're in Christ?
We can't. If you're in Christ, you can't. He's talking to those
who's got the clothes but don't have it on.
Okay, he's talking to those who, and I think primarily a big part of this, I don't think it's all of it, but a big part of it, and we'll see that as we go into the next chapter here, has to do with those who claim to be followers of his, but are not true followers.
And this is a warning.
This is a warning to them. This is what's getting ready to happen. This destruction is getting ready to come upon those who are disobedient to God, who are living in rebellion to him. Dale?
I kind of see the symbolism of this as being, you know, when we're naked, you know, we don't have any protection from anything, but whenever we become Christians, we're given the white robe of righteousness by Jesus, which is available to everybody. But not everybody has made the effort to put that on and receive the protection that he's providing that's going to be so important as this is going on. It says that if you stay awake, in other words, you're alert, you're aware of what's going on, and you've chosen the right set of clothing of Christ in order to be prepared for what's about to happen.
Exactly. The Apostle Paul says all those who have been baptized into Christ have what? Have put on Christ. Or have clothed themselves with Christ. So that's what we wear. Again, keep in mind, who is this being written to?
Christians.
Okay. All right, it's being written to Christians to, again, as we said, we've been saying all along here, to encourage them, don't give up. And so as Jesus makes his statement, behold, I come like a thief. Okay, make sure you don't give up. He's talking to those who belong to him, because they can give up. Okay? We can give up. We can get so discouraged that we just give up and fall away from the Lord. You see? So it is a warning to those who are, you know, wavering in their faith and wanting to give up. Not those who are struggling in their faith in terms of, you know, I'm trying to do what I need to, but, you know, I keep stumbling and so forth. That's a whole different group of people here. Okay? Right? We need to be rest assured in the promises of God. If we belong to Christ, and we maintain and are faithful to him, what is the promise? Okay. Be faithful, how? Unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. That is a promise. Faithful does not mean completely without any sin or stumbling or what have you. Okay? Faithful means I am striving to live my life each day for Jesus.
But if you walk away...
You walk away, and that's what he's talking about. You walk away, then you're putting yourself in jeopardy. Okay?
Well, you had that lesson before. You know, as long as we remain in that scarlet ribbon, then we are safe. But when we step out of it,
right,
we are lost, or we found naked.
Right.
Okay, but we have the opportunity to come back into that covering.
Right.
So, it's those that are outside of
Christ.
If
we walk in the light as he
is
in
the
light. Remember that, okay, Charlotte?
Well, I'm glad you made that clear, because you know when Chuck asked the question, "Who is naked? Who will be caught naked?" And then you say, you know, like, we are covered. Christians are covered. Well, you have some Christians out there that have fallen short, that are out there still actually thinking, well, I'm covered.
Right.
So I'm glad you made that
clear.
You know, if you're on the outside of Christ, regardless of whether you, you know, a Christian or not, you're on the outside.
That's right.
And if you don't try to get back in before that time, then you are considered one of the naked ones.
Exactly.
So I'm glad that was made, because I'm sitting here thinking, okay, you're a Christian, but you're on the outside, so you had, you know, you're covered. I wasn't understanding.
Only if you fall away, if you give your faith up and you walk away from the Lord, then you're in actuality, if you look at this, you're no better off than the rest of the world who, you know, has denounced Christ.
You're worse off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you have the knowledge, and then
exactly.
But you have Christians that think that.
Well,
just
you
because
have people
been baptized and they're doing everything they want to do.
Well, I would suggest to you, Charlotte, let me correct you if you don't mind here. You say they are Christians, and I say. They claim to be Christians, but they are not true Christians.
Right.
And that's
right.
The big problem.
Right.
And I think that's what we're looking at. Again, go back to what we looked at a couple chapters ago. I keep referencing this back. Don't forget about measuring the temple and the altar.
The outer court.
Not the outer court. What does the outer court represent?
The so-called Christians.
Those who claim to be, they look like they're Christians, but they are not faithful to God. He said, don't measure them. Why? Because they don't belong to him. Judy?
Well, it also goes back to when at the judgment day, they come to Jesus and say, have we not done all these things
all
that
these
you commanded?
Things.
But basically, Jesus said, you don't belong to me. You are naked. You are not covered by me.
He says, I don't know you.
I don't know you.
I don't know who you are. Okay? So it really is a matter of, and again, but keep in mind, this is not where I've got to be in sinless perfection. That's not what it's about. But I am striving
each day
to live my life for God.
I thank you because we have to be ready to try to explain this.
Exactly.
And I thank you because I want to explain to people when they are on the outside. But
absolutely.
Yet you're thinking that.
You think just because you claim to believe in Jesus and you've accepted him as your Savior and now you can live however you want to live because you're saved, once saved, always saved, that's hogwash.
Yeah.
That's not a biblical term, by the way. Hogwash is okay. Chuck?
But this is a warning.
Yes.
And you know, that's how awesome God is. He's not going to, there wouldn't be, there's no need for a warning if there's no hope.
Right.
All the way to the end.
Exactly. And again, this goes back to what we've been saying all along also, just the whole idea. What is, again, the purpose of this? You've got Christians in the first century when they receive this, you know, who are discouraged because they're being persecuted. Their world is in turmoil. And it seems hopeless, okay? And they needed these words of encouragement to say, hold on, don't give up. Okay? Don't give up. So you don't lose your soul.
And I think
and it's still applied to us today.
Exactly.
You see? So that's why, you know, again, I keep telling you this, reminding you, quit worrying about plugging in people at events. When it happens, it's going to happen. The issue is be ready when it happens. You see? These things are given, okay, as a warning to the first century Christians. Basically, it says, look, you don't want to be caught outside of Christ when he comes. Because this is the description of what's going to happen when that time comes. That same thing is just as valid today for you and I. You don't want to be found outside of Christ when this comes. When's he going to come? Could be today. Could be another 100 years from now. And there will be other world issues going on that will be just as tragic, just as scary and everything else as what's going on in the world today. It'll just be 100 years down the road. Okay? And that's the thing we have to keep in mind. All right? Geraldine?
I know I'm speaking on myself also, but we as a whole that are still in the church and trying very hard to do the right thing, and we know all these Church of Christ members are out there. A lot of them we know. But we as a whole, it's our responsibility as a whole to try and help those people.
I think we have a responsibility to share with them, try to encourage them,
right.
But, you know, that can only go with so far. They know the truth and they've walked away from it. You know, they're responsible for that. And they will give an account to God. You knew the truth, but yet you walked away. Now, you know, I'm not saying don't encourage them. We need to and try to urge them to come back before it's too late. Okay? But it's like everybody else. It's their choice. Mm-hmm. And just like Charlotte was mentioned a moment ago, people that, you know, she knows that people that think they're Christians, which I think a lot of those people probably do. You know, people that have been in the church, oh, yeah, I'm saved. I, you know, I, you know. but they're not living their life for the Lord. We have a responsibility to all to do what he's saying. And that, in fact, that's part of what we looked at a few weeks back, that we have that job of warning people. You know, to still let them know there's still time and you need to get your act together. You see? Before this time comes. Because, again, the issue is we don't know when it's going to be. Don't know. So, yeah, share it with as many people as you can.
I agree. We need to share it with everybody, and we're focusing here on when that time comes. That time comes when you die.
Yep.
If you don't have to wait till the last day, your time is up when you die,
absolutely.
And it's too late.
And
you
then
know?
That's, you know, it's over with.
Right.
Absolutely. And in that case, those who are the dead in Christ, what happens to them?
They rise first.
Yeah.
Okay? They rise first. All right. So again, all these things, this earthquake, this severe earthquake, this hailstorm, these are symbols of this judgment that is going to come at the wrath of God. And notice that he says here, what is the terminology that he uses here? Verse 19. Concerning Babylon, God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Dale, you brought up last week, I think it was, the question of the issue of Babylon. We're going to see that again in this next part. Again, is it talking about physical Babylon here, the city of Babylon? No. There's some archaeological digs where those archaeologists think, well, we think we found the city of Babylon. Okay, I saw some pictures of what they found the other day. It's just total ruins. Right? It's not talking about the physical city of Babylon. What does Babylon represent in the scriptures?
Power.
Not just power, but...
What?
It was a great city. It was a great world power. Okay? You what?
They were the enemies of God's people.
Yeah. It represents evil and sinfulness and every kind of debauchery that there is in the world.
They're the ones that took Israel into captivity.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Babylon symbolically represents the enemies of God. Okay? And so God is going to pour out his wrath upon his enemies. And how much of his wrath?
All of it.
All of it. The full fury, he says, of his wrath upon those who are the enemies of God. All right? Any question there at all? Okay, let's start in the next part here. We're not going to get all through this, but chapter 17... talking about the harlot, okay? As you begin in this first couple of verses here, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." What is the great harlot? Well, under here, which I think is right, the apostate church sells herself for money, power, whatever you want it to. Think about. So he's going to take him and show him the judgment of the great harlot. All right. And then this next part: with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Now, question. Why this use of the word and this symbolism of the harlot and this terminology? She's committed fornication with the kings of the world and so forth. What is the symbolism of all of this, and what does this woman represent? Again, another one of those issues in you know, folks that study the prophecies and so forth, they got all kinds of answers as to who this woman is. I had another thing on here. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So, what is this issue of this of the harlot and so forth? Dale?
Even from Old Testament times, like the prophet Hosea, you know, the being either promiscuous or being a harlot was correlated with being unfaithful to
Unfaithfulness.
God.
Yeah. Look at Jeremiah 3, verses 6 through 9. All right? This gives us an example of how God looks upon the whole issue of unfaithfulness. During the reign of King Josiah, the Lord said to me, "Have you seen what faithless Israel has done? She has gone up on every high hill and under every spreading tree and done what? Committed adultery," he says. It committed adultery. "I thought that after she had done all of this, she would return to me, but she did not. And her unfaithful sister, Judah, saw it." Okay? "I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all of her adulteries. Yet I saw that her unfaithful sister, Judah, had no fear. She also went out and committed adultery, because Israel's immorality mattered so little to her. She defiled the land," and look at this, "committed adultery with what?
Stone
and wood." What is that a reference to? The idols that Israel worshipped and ran after.
Yeah.
And God looked upon that as adultery. So Israel was a harlot as far as he was concerned. Sharing herself with whoever. And not being faithful to God. That's one reason, by the way, that God looks so badly upon adultery in relationships, in marriages and so forth. Okay? Yeah. Right? It is unfaithfulness to the promises and the covenant that Israel made with God. Okay? So, now we're out of time here. Keep this in mind. We're going to pick up here next week. I want you to be thinking about that and look at that in terms of identifying who is this harlot that it's referring to as we look at, you know, what's going to happen to this harlot. All right? And keep that this aspect of it in mind. All right? Thank you all very much. We will pick up here next week.